more headlines. Iran warns against any Israeli adventurism toward its nuclear program, saying Tel Aviv's provocative threats against Tehran have increased in an alarming rate. Syrian media say the country's air defenses have confronted an Israeli attack in Homs province. And in Norway, at least five people are killed by a man armed with a bow and arrows. Police say they cannot rule out terrorist motive. Well, welcome from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Thanks for joining us. Even with our top story, the Iranian ambassador to the United Nations has warned against any Israeli miscalculation or adventurism toward his country's nuclear program. In a letter to the president of the UN Security Council, Majid Takht Ravanchi said Israel's provocative threats against Iran have increased in an alarming rate. He cited Israeli official statements as saying that the regime is accelerating its strike plans against Iran. The envoy said such statements are a clear violation of international law, particularly the UN Charter. Takht Ravanchi noted that Israel was undoubtedly behind acts of sabotage against Iran's nuclear program in the past. He urged the world body to hold Israel accountable for its destabilizing acts. Political commentator Kevin Barrett says it is unlikely that the United Nations take any stance against Israeli threats, as the world body is controlled by big powers beholden to Tel Aviv.
Israelis are once again threatening to commit the supreme war crime, and the United Nations needs to do something about it, because if Israel, and when Israel attacks Iran, Iran has every right to retaliate in kind proportionately under international law, and that could set off a tit-for-tat of escalation that could lead to a crisis, and that's what the United Nations is supposed to be there for, is to prevent such things from happening. But because the UN is so dominated by these great powers that are essentially controlled by Israel, it's not much good at stopping Israeli aggression.
An Iranian envoy to the United Nations has branded Israel the chief obstacle to a nuke-free Middle East. Addressing a UN General Assembly committee, Haider Ali Baluchi said Israel is among major importers of U.S. weapons and uses them to create instability and insecurity in the region. Baluchi called on the international community to pressure Israel into joining the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. He further warned that plans to modernize nuclear weapons undermined international peace and intensified nuclear arms races. Israel is believed to have up to 400 nuclear warheads. Israeli warplanes have carried out airstrikes on several targets in Syria's Homs province. One Syrian soldier has been killed and three others wounded in the attacks. Our correspondent in Damascus, Mohammed Ali, joined us earlier with more details about the raids.
An official military source confirmed the attack, saying that Israeli fighter jets carried out an aggression at 11:34 p.m. local time here in Syria, targeting an area south of Palmyra, which is in Homs governorate. The Israeli fighter jets destroyed and attacked a communication tower over there in that area, and also killed one Syrian soldier and injured three others. Because what Israel targeted seems to be not just that communication tower, but also several other positions for the Syrian army south of Palmyra in central Syria. Now, this is definitely not the first attack of its kind. Just a week ago, exactly, there was a similar attack by Israel, and also from the same direction. Fighter jets came from Al Tanf area, which is a U.S.-occupied part of Syria in the east. Fighter jets came from that direction, the Israeli fighter jets, and attacked also Homs countryside.
Russian President Vladimir Putin says militants from Iraq and Syria are actively entering Afghanistan.
A number of international terrorist groups from Daesh continue to operate in the country. Militants from Iraq, Syria, with experience in military operations, are actively being drawn there.
Putin made the remark during a video conference with security service chiefs of ex-Soviet states. He said it is possible that terrorists may try to destabilize the situation in Afghanistan's neighbors, including the Central Asian countries. He also warned that the terrorists could even try, quote, direct expansion. Putin has repeatedly warned about members of extremist groups exploiting political turmoil in Afghanistan to cross into neighboring ex-Soviet countries as refugees. Political commentator Daniel Lazar says that Putin's concern about the presence of foreign militants in Afghanistan is well-founded.
Oh, I think those concerns are well-founded. I have no doubt that militants from throughout the Middle East are now flocking to Afghanistan. They regard Afghanistan as a sponsor. The question is how it affects the internal dynamics in Afghanistan, the struggle between the Taliban and Daesh or ISIS or Islamic State, whatever you want to call it, and also what the role of the U.S. is in all this. Is the U.S. encouraging militants to travel to Afghanistan? Is it siding with the Taliban against ISIS, or is it siding with ISIS against the Taliban? I suspect that some Saudi money is flowing to ISIS. I suspect the U.S. is aware of that and is not saying no.
The latest results from Iraq's parliamentary elections show that senior cleric Muqtada Sadr-Bak still maintains most seats. The results announced by the Electoral Commission indicate that the Sadr movement has won 72 seats in the 329-member parliament. The body said the final official results will be published 20 days later after addressing all complaints. Earlier, the Fatah Alliance challenged the results, calling them fabricated. The alliance has only garnered over a dozen seats, down from 48 it won in the 2018 election. The parliamentary elections were held at the weekend.
People in Iraq have voted in parliamentary elections, which have been held earlier than their original 2022 schedule, in response to the public demands for economic reforms. Muqtada al-Sadr's party has become the biggest winner. Initial results show the party swept the vote and increased the number of seats the influential cleric holds in parliament. Sadr's party, known as the Sadrist Movement, is reported to have managed to secure more than 70 of the 329-seat parliament. The Shia scholar, who has been a dominant figure in Iraqi politics since the US invasion in 2003, has boosted his power in the Arab country since coming first in the 2018 election, in which his coalition, the biggest bloc, Sayrun, secured 54 seats. Sadr's party, however, is unable to form a government on its own and needs to form a coalition with some other parties. Sadr, who opposed all foreign interference in Iraq, has warned all foreign embassies not to interfere in Iraq's internal affairs.
We won't allow parties to take control of public money and resources. They are for the people. Every corrupt person will be held accountable, whoever they are.
It is not clear what Muqtada Sadr was referring to when he spoke about having all embassies welcome as long as they don't interfere in internal affairs of Iraq. Big question marks are up in the air right now because his relationships with the Saudi government.
The Sadr bloc now has to form a coalition with one of the other groups since there is no majority in parliament. The real question is whether the Iraqis' demands will be met. The youths who forced the vote to take place earlier than scheduled have spoken out against corruption, failed governance, and economic challenges. But there is an even more important matter that the current government has to deal with: allegations of vote rigging.
The Iraqi people voted in their country's parliamentary elections on Sunday to decide the 329 members of the Council of Representatives, who will, in turn, elect the president and confirm the prime minister. The vote also took place under a new election law that divided Iraq into smaller constituencies, another demand of the protesters, and allowed for more independent candidates. Meanwhile, the leader of Iraq's Fatah Conquest Alliance political coalition has dismissed the preliminary results of the country's recent parliamentary elections, describing them as fabricated. The comments were made by Hadi al-Amiri, the secretary general of the Badr organization, a political party close to Hashd al-Sha'abi. Separately, the Coordinating Committee of Shia Parties in Iraq has rejected the results of the national elections and raised strong objection over what it described as the High Electoral Commission's failure to honor its obligations. The committee is comprised of the Fatah Alliance, the State of Law Alliance, Asib al-Al-Haq Political Party, Kataib Hezbollah, as well as other Shia factions. The coordinating committee says the commission had pledged to address all these problems with practical steps. It, however, failed to take the legal measures it had earlier pledged to adopt.
We will not withdraw, will not stand back. We'll continue to defend your voices. This is for all our people, all our brothers and sisters who have run for the elections, the candidates, all those candidates that gave in objections and complaints from this election, first of all, in order to fight or defend their voices and votes of our supporters, but also the votes of all the Iraqis.
The statement by the Fatah Coalition and Hezbollah, Kataib Hezbollah Iraq, and other resistance factions in Iraq about the results of the elections must cause everybody to pause and think about this.
According to the preliminary results of Iraq's parliamentary elections, the Fatah Alliance won 14 seats in 2020. It had secured 48 seats in the 2018 vote. The State of Law Alliance, headed by former Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki, who led Iraq from 2006 to 2014, came third overall with 37. Kurdish parties won 61 seats, including 32 for the Kurdistan Democratic Party, which dominates the government of the semi-autonomous Kurdish region of Iraq, and 15 for its rival, the Patriotic Union of Kurdistan Party. Sunni Parliament Speaker Mohammad al-Halbusi's Taqaddum Coalition won 38 seats, Iraq's state news agency reported, making it the second largest in parliament.
Now to Norway, where a man has killed at least five people and wounded two others using a bow and arrows. The attack took place in the southern town of Kongsberg. The suspect, who is believed to have acted alone, is now in custody. Authorities say they cannot rule out terrorist motive for the attack. Police have ordered officers nationwide to carry firearms, but they say they have no indication that there is a change in the national threat level. Norwegian policemen are normally unarmed, but officers have access to guns and rifles when needed. Some may forget that the issue which initially completed France's yellow vests to hit the streets was record-high gasoline prices. The price of diesel gas just hit a new record in France amid across-the-board inflation. Now the question is, will popular discontent return less than 6 months ahead of the presidential election? Ramin Mazohiri has more from Paris.
In October 2018, a liter of fuel in diesel-dominated France hit €1.53. And for the next 7 months, every Saturday in Paris was a war zone of state repression. The price of diesel gas has just surpassed that all-time record, and many wonder if a return of the yellow vests is now around the corner. After the unprecedented corona lockdowns, diesel, petrol, natural gas, electricity, and prices in general continue to soar worldwide. Inflation in France has just accelerated to the highest rate in 10 years. Western leaders continue to insist the inflation is temporary, but many in France say the economic tension is undeniable.
I would very much like Macron to recognize that the French cannot live with this type of inflation. I normally budget €60 to fill up my car, but today I paid €80. All these price increases in so many areas are a real catastrophe for the French.
Gasoline taxes are regressive taxes because they place the same costs on rich and poor alike. 60% of France's gasoline costs are due to taxation. Many drivers wonder if the right-wing government of Emmanuel Macron is prepared to ease this winter's burden on the average household by making the wealthy and big business pay a fair share.
The government must stabilize the petrol prices at a normal level. That would permit the people to get some financial breathing space. But the main problem is that of salaries. Both the legal minimum salary and the national average salary are not sufficient for the people to live upon anymore. And this has to be openly admitted and changed.
As cold weather nears, a 250% increase in natural gas is forcing European governments to take last-minute action, including caps to corporate profits in left-leaning Spain. France's government is set to announce a small one-time payment for only the poorest households to combat energy costs, which show no sign of easing. France uses the third most natural gas in Europe. The persistent price rises and entrenched unemployment may upend Western plans to finally end quantitative easing and zero interest rate policies, which have produced record economic inequality. Those policies and the disastrous Corona recession may have already set the stage for the next economic era across the West, dreaded stagflation. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
The U.S. Justice Department has launched a probe into reports of physical and sexual abuse in juvenile detention centers in the state of Texas. The investigation will focus on five secure facilities across Texas. The department plans to probe excessive use of chemical restraints and isolation and a lack of adequate mental health services. At least 11 staff members of Texas facilities have been arrested over sexual abuse of children in their care. This is the latest in the probes the Justice Department has launched into systematic patterns of abuse and misconduct by police and prison officials. Similar investigations are underway in Georgia state prisons and police departments in Minneapolis and Louisville. That does it for this edition of World News. Thanks for your company.
This is IRIB English Radio. Iranian news. Iranian culture. Iranian voice. www.parstoday.com/en.
Beneath this benign facade lies a vast network where Facebook profits by promoting discord, violence, human trafficking, and by driving young people into a self-loathing that can spiral into depression and suicide. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written jointly by Amy Goodman and Dennis Mohinen Writers. This article is published under the heading, After Whistleblower Revelations, It's Time to Unfriend Facebook. Stay tuned for more. Facebook has grown into a planet-wide $1 trillion company that allows people to connect online with family and friends, sharing photos and liking the posts of others. Beneath this benign facade lies a vast network where Facebook profits by promoting discord, violence, human trafficking, and by driving young people into a self-loathing that can spiral into depression and suicide. Facebook knows all this. A trove of leaked internal Facebook documents led to a recent series of explosive exposés by the Wall Street Journal. Recently, the whistleblower who released the documents, Francis Hogan, appeared on CBS 60 Minutes, then went before a Senate Commerce subcommittee. Congressional and antitrust action is needed now to rein in this sprawling global monopoly that profits off pain. spoke and testified, I saw Facebook repeatedly encounter conflicts between its own profits and our safety. Facebook consistently resolved these conflicts in favor of its own profits. The result has been more division, more harm, more lies, more threats, and more combat. This dangerous online talk has led to actual violence that harms and even kills people. Facebook has an estimated 3 billion users around the world and also owns Instagram and WhatsApp, social media applications with another combined 3 billion users. Instagram, popular with teens, encourages users to post selfies and videos. Metrics like the number of followers one has or the number of likes, dislikes, and shares data post services weigh heavily on the psyches of many of these young users, often negatively. This exchange from Hogan's 60 Minutes interview illustrates the problem. Scott Pelley, one study says 13.5% of teen girls say Instagram makes thoughts of suicide worse. 17% of teen girls say Instagram makes eating disorders worse. Francis Hogan, what's super tragic is Facebook's own research says, as these young people begin to consume this eating disorder content, they get more and more depressed, and this actually makes them use the app more. So they end up in this feedback cycle where they hate their bodies more and more. Facebook's own research says it is not just that Instagram is dangerous for teenagers, that it harms teenagers. It's that it is distinctly worse than other forms of social media. Among the documents obtained by the Wall Street Journal was a leaked slide from a 2019 internal Facebook Instagram presentation entitled Teen Mental Health Deep Dive. In it, company researchers admit, we make body image issues worse for 1 in 3 teen girls. A list follows specifying how. Teens specifically call out the following as ways that Instagram harms their mental health. Pressure to conform to social stereotypes, pressure to match the money and body shapes of influencers, the need for validation, views, likes, followers, friendship conflicts, bullying, hate speech, inappropriate advertisements targeting to vulnerable groups. Facebook's targeting of teens has been compared to big tobacco covering up the harmful and addictive properties of cigarettes for decades, while hooking younger and younger smokers. The destructive web of toxic content pushed through Facebook and Instagram goes much further. As the leaked documents reveal, Facebook has known for years that its platforms are used by criminal organizations. Mexican cartels have used Facebook to recruit young people to become killers and to post videos celebrating their violent acts. Human trafficking organizations use Facebook to recruit domestic workers for assignments in the West Asia region, then confiscate the passports of these workers, many of whom come from Africa, and then sell the work contracts. Workers are then often subjected to slavery-like conditions, some even shackled to prevent flight. In conflict zones, Facebook has played a central role in fanning the flames of racial and ethnic hatred, encouraging violence that has contributed to mass murder and ethnic cleansing against minority populations like the Rohingya Muslims in Burma and against the Tigrayan people in Ethiopia. Facebook has known that its platform was causing harm, but has refused to take action. CEO Mark Zuckerberg himself has intervened, overriding company investigators who suggest fixes to these problems that might impact Facebook's profitability. Facebook and Zuckerberg refuse to hire enough content monitors, especially in languages other than English, which make up the vast majority of users, or to adjust the secret algorithm that drives the company's enormous profits. The shocking part here is the number of bald-faced lies repeated over and over again. Jessica Gonzalez, co-CEO of the media advocacy organization Free Press, said on the Democracy Now! NewsHour, "It indicates clearly that Facebook is unfit to self-govern and that we need the U.S. Congress and the administration to step in and provide transparency and accountability. We, our attention, our time spent on these sites and apps are the product that Facebook sells to advertisers. We must demand accountability. Congressional and antitrust action is needed now to rein in this sprawling global monopoly that profits off pain," unquote.
Food for thought.
Hello everyone, and here is a statement on the philosophy of fasting from the Holy Prophet's 11th infallible heir, Imam Hassan Askari, peace be upon him. Allah has decreed fasting so that the wealthy might suffer hunger and be kind to the poor.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, Divine Chastisement. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Divine chastisements are indeed reflections of man's actions as well as the consequences of his sins. Sometimes they appear as an unpleasant situation in material life, and sometimes in spiritual matters, such as the lack of enthusiasm for worship and invocation to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. But the worst punishment meted out is that of making a person hard-hearted. The heart becomes devoid of humanitarian feelings, philanthropy, and sympathy, and leads to perpetration of cruelty and many other sins. Imam Bakr alayhi salam has said, "God chastises man for sins and disobedience through the spirit and the body, indigence in livelihood, indolence in worship, But God has not punished any servant with something worse than hard-heartedness. Brothers and sisters, there are different types of punishments from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. When He punishes a human being, it is based on the reasons that the human being brings about for himself. Allah is not unjust. He does not want to punish you, and He has given you the rules to follow. But we, the human beings, we become negligent. We become worthy of those punishments and those chastisements, let it be in this world or the hereafter. Welcome back, dear listeners. Today we are discussing the topic of divine chastisement, and we said that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala does not want to punish human beings, but He has defined the rules. If anybody violates those rules, this means it's their decision that they want to bring Allah's punishment and chastisement into action. So, in order for us to be able to save ourselves from this chastisement and this punishment, we need to follow the rules. It's as simple as that. Now, we can have very complicated discussion on the topic, but honestly, it is a very simple thing, right? Yes, I do realize and understand it's not easy to live a life where we can save and secure ourselves from Allah's punishment, but at the same time, brothers and sisters, you have to have faith. It's not that difficult either. You just have to be careful. You just have to be conscious about everything you do in your life. And God forbid, the worst of the chastisement that Allah has put for all of us, according to the traditions of Islam, is the hard-heartedness. Hard-heartedness is something after which, if God forbid somebody becomes a victim of it, after this, a person is not open to divine guidance anymore. His heart is not welcoming of truth and justice. Now, this is difficult. This is hard. And who is responsible for this hard-heartedness? It is us, ourselves. We bring it upon ourselves through our actions and inactions in some cases. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at parsetoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Postal Service has come up with an innovative idea to speed up the mail sorting process, not by humans, but a fleet of robots. 55 tiny yellow robots, powered by artificial intelligence, are helping employees in Hellenic Post Sorting Center. They scan postal codes to identify the bundle's destination, weigh the parcels, and put them in related platforms. The program aims to handle increasing number of packages from online shopping, especially during the pandemic.
The end result is a threefold increase in sorting speed of parcels, ensuring next day delivery for our customers. These autonomous mobile robots are energy efficient, thus directly reducing the energy consumption of the sorting process, and that way allowing us to take a greener approach to operations.
According to the company, up to 80% of mail sorting has been passed to the four-wheeled robots. Each day, these little machines manage around 168,000 packages weighing up to 15 kilograms. Every 4 hours, they need recharging, which takes 5 minutes.
underwater museum in Turkey is offering a unique opportunity to its visitors. Diving back in time, the World War I era naval battle site turned into an underwater park on Turkey's Yapoli Peninsula, and it has recently opened its doors to the public. The area is known as the graveyard of the navies and includes dozens of shipwrecks from battles dating back to the early 20th century.
One of the most exciting things about diving is shipwrecks, of course. They remind you of the past, and it's like a time machine that takes you back to 1915.
The British Royal Battleship HMS Majestic is one of the first ships that divers see as they start their underwater journey. The vessel sank during the First World War and rests more than 24 meters below the ocean's surface, but it still remains intact. Remains of 14 British, French, and Australian warships are over there. Museum officials say they want the site to become a new hub for divers who wish to explore historical events.
Russia has sent an actress and a director to space to make the world's first movie in orbit. The crew blasted off from Kazakhstan for the International Space Station along with a cosmonaut and successfully reached the orbit. They spent 4 months on preparation for the flight. After 12 days in space, they will return to Earth. The movie, named Challenge, is about a doctor who goes to the space station to treat an astronaut with a heart ailment. Russian officials say the project will help burnish the nation's space glory. Australian scientists have developed artificial structures that act as a much-needed habitat for marine life.
It's extremely exciting because we have seen a total of more than 90 species colonizing these diverse panels. And we see 30 to 40% more species on the panels in the living seawalls than on the unmodified parts of the seawall, so the seawalls with no panels. So that's extremely exciting and really gives us confidence to scale this up to other environments and other artificial structures.
The project has installed over 1,000 artificially designed panels onto seawalls in Sydney. These craggy concrete panels are 3D printed and designed to last for at least 20 years. Only a short time after installation, they turned into a cozy new home for the fish, crustaceans, and other marine life.
So we have more fish in Sydney Harbour than we have in the entire UK coast. So we have more than 500 species of fish in the harbour, so that's quite impressive. But what we notice is that urbanization and the human settling, especially towards the coast, has a lot of impacts on this amazing marine environment, and that's what we are trying to mitigate a bit with the living seawalls. By attaching these panels that mimic natural features such as rocky shores and rock pools and crevices and nooks and crannies.
After becoming popular in Australia, the panels were also installed in Wales and Singapore. The scientists say since the installation of these panels, the quality of Sydney's harbour water has improved. They hope coastal structures built in the future would be ecologically sustainable, designed not only for humans, but for nature.
Plastic pollution has become one of the most pressing environmental issues as disposable products overwhelm the world's ability to deal with them. Indonesian activists have come up with an idea to convince people to rethink their habits and say no to single-use bags and bottles. Environmentalists have created a museum made entirely from plastic waste in the town of Gressing in East Java. It took them 3 months to collect used plastic items, ranging from bottles and bags to sachets and straws.
They were all assembled from polluted rivers and beaches. The centerpiece of this museum is a statue whose skirt is made from single-use sachets of household items. The museum has become a popular location for selfies and has received more than 400 visitors since it opened last month.
I will definitely change my life habits. For example, like when I go to the market or to a grocery store that provides a plastic bag, I will switch to a tote bag. And when I buy a drink, I will use a tumbler.
Environmentalists say the plan behind the exhibition was to send a message about the world's worsening ocean plastic crisis. The plastic problem is particularly acute in Indonesia, a nation that ranks second only behind China for its volume of plastics that end up in the seas.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
People around the world celebrate the changing seasons in different ways. In the U.S., an annual pumpkin contest is held to kick off the fall season. Each year, farmers and vegetable enthusiasts from across the U.S. gather in New England for the competition. Anyone bringing the largest homegrown pumpkin gets the prize. This year, a man from Abington, Connecticut, got the prize for his pumpkin weighing more than 2,000 pounds. Alex Noel explains how he worked hard to produce that giant pumpkin.
A nearly unlimited amount of work goes into producing a 2,000-pound-plus pumpkin. I put about 1,000 hours a season into 2 to 3 giant pumpkins, and you're lucky if you even get that many by the end of the year. I'm out there watering, fertilizing, keeping excess water off if it's too rainy, which it was this year, spraying insecticides, spraying fungicides, pruning, training vines, dropping up leaves at the end of the season, putting blankets on when it's cold out, heating cables, fans. I mean, the list goes on and on.
The New England Giant Pumpkin Weigh-Off began at the Topsfield Fair in 1984. That year, the winner showcased a pumpkin weighing 196 kilograms. The weigh-off has received worldwide recognition, too. Syria's ancient city of Aleppo seems getting a taste of normalcy amid reconstruction efforts in the war-ravaged city. A Syrian historian has also been contributing to make the city regain its lost glory. Ala al-Sayed is working to faithfully restore the lost sections of Aleppo's old city. For that, he is using documents and clippings he himself saved during the early years of the conflict. He says he came up with the idea to digitalize those documents in 2013. Then he embarked on organizing newspapers, books, and pamphlets while scanning each one to add to his digital library. Following the liberation of Aleppo, Ala came back to the city and started renovating historic places which are on the World Heritage List.
The North Dublin suburb of Howth has a new highly efficient firefighting crew. The group has 25 members, but none of them are human.
Howth was targeted by a lot of fire, and so there's a lot of gorse here, and it's very flammable. The goats, on the other hand, love gorse, so it's a win-win in that sense. I suppose the project also focuses on the old Irish goat, defining their role as a functional biodiversity crew. They're a hard-working crew. They're up for the job, they're keen to do it. It also instills key conservation grazing principles to tackle fire prevention and habitat management and the control of invasive species. So it's the old Irish ladies that have a job to do here and are well able to do it.
The goats graze eagerly on the ample gorse bushes, which are highly inflammable and cause blazes in hot weather. The local council hopes their deployment will make Howth less susceptible to wildfires. Conservationists also hope that the project will contribute to the survival of the old Irish goats, which almost went extinct in the last century. Each member of the herd has a box around their neck with a built-in GPS device. If the goats stray too far, the gadget will ping and let the owner know.
Five Siberian tiger cubs born in a South Korean zoo have made their first public debut. The cubs were born at Everland Theme Park in Yongin in late June. Their birth brought joy and hope to wildlife enthusiasts as they are listed as endangered species. Zookeepers say it's unusual for Siberian tigers to give birth to five babies at once. South Korean people selected the cubs' names through an online vote. Many exotic fruit plants need the tropical climate to grow, but Assyrian is producing nearly 100 types of tropical fruits at his backyard in a coastal city of Tartus. Mohammed Hassan's passion for agriculture is to the extent that he left his job in media to build a farm. He managed to create a tropical environment at his compound, and that was the reason behind his success in growing fruits that are rare in many parts of the world. In fact, he has turned his farm into what he likes to be described as a tropical cave.
I came across the world of tropical fruits as some of them existed here. Many immigrants also helped me on this path. They bought me special varieties from India, South America, the Caribbean and other countries, even China. Currently, we grow 93 types of fruits.
Hassan's success has encouraged other Tartus residents to create their own farms. The government is also assisting Hassan with his unique business. His farm is now open to tourists and visitors where they can taste the products. Hassan says he has bigger plans for the future and is thinking about using his tropical environment to raise and breed rainforest animals. In Brazil, paleontologists have discovered the fossilized remains of a dinosaur that lived roughly 70 million years ago.
It's a bipedal dinosaur with short arms, around 5 meters long, and it was at the top of the food chain in the period in which it lived. It was the predator at the time.
Paleontologists say the fossil suggests a dinosaur species known as Kurupi itata was a meat eater. They found the ancient predator's remains at one of Brazil's richest sites for dinosaur findings in the city of Sao Paulo. The first piece of Kurupi itata's fossil was unearthed during an excavation work in 2002. Until the completion of the research, a model of this species would be on display at Monte Alto's Museum of Paleontology. Experts believe the discovery would help scientists better understand paleontology on Brazilian lands.
Technology plays an important role in our daily lives. This time, a French company has introduced a device to help the visually impaired to avoid obstacles. The smart electronic device detects obstacles and warns users with a beep. People with vision loss can install it on the top of their canes and receive information through headphones. The gadget helps people to dodge barriers on the ground and above that, for example, the open door of a truck.
If you hear the sound to the right, it means that the obstacle is on the right. If it is straight ahead, the obstacles are in front of you. So you change course according to what you hear. If you hear an obstacle to the left, you go to the right, and this way you can go around the obstacle.
The device costs around $2,300 and is now being used by hundreds of people in Belgium, France, Germany, Italy, and Switzerland.
Thank you.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
U.S. Marshals Service task forces have faced increased scrutiny in recent years for the number of people they kill during arrests. A February analysis from the Marshall Project found that between 2015 and 2020, U.S. Marshals task force members or local police assisting in a Marshall's arrest shot 177 people. 124 of them fatally. Seven more people died by suicide after being shot. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Akila Lacey Ryder. This article is published under the heading Video Shows U.S. Marshals Task Force Brutalizing Teenage Boys in Mississippi. Stay tuned for more. U.S. Marshals arrested two boys ages 17 and 16 in Jackson, Mississippi on September 16th on charges related to August shootings in the nearby city of Canton. Footage of the arrest shows one officer leading a shirtless, handcuffed boy past another officer, who reaches out and hits the boy across the face, making a loud noise on impact and leaving him bleeding from his mouth or nose. According to a lawyer representing one of the teens and his mother, both boys have said that officers physically assaulted them while they were handcuffed, including whipping them with a green extension cord outside the camera's view. The FBI and the U.S. Justice Department are investigating the arrest. The officers are part of the U.S. Marshals Service Gulf Coast Regional Fugitive Task Force, a federally funded unit that shot and killed a 20-year-old man in Memphis, Tennessee, while serving a warrant for a Mississippi shooting in 2019. Established in 2006, the task force operates in Alabama and Mississippi and deputizes state and local officers as marshals, offering them expanded powers to target people wanted for violent crimes. Their conferred status provides them with privileges including the ability to work across jurisdictions and make arrests without warrants. The marshals do not wear body cameras. The September arrest was instead captured on a Ring doorbell camera. The day after, Jackson's local CBS-affiliate WJTV reported on a segment of the footage in which an officer hits and yells at one boy, and the boy calls into the security camera for his mother, who was out of the town at the time. The Intercept obtained more of the footage, which shows officers feather braiding both boys as well as a middle-aged woman, then taking what appears to be the green extension cord with them from the scene. According to the mother of one of the boys, at least one major national network had the full video footage but has not pursued a story. The woman in the video who was house-sitting at the time of the arrest said officers hit her in the head and pointed guns at her before shoving her to the ground in handcuffs and verbally berating her. She is the god-sister of Kawanda Harris, the mother of one of the teens, and asked not to be named by the press. Both women say that the officers never produced an arrest warrant for the boys. The U.S. Marshals Service is aware of an incident that occurred involving members of our multi-agency Gulf Coast Regional Task Force, GCRTF, in Mississippi. Justice Department Office of Public Affairs spokesperson Ariel Bradford said in a statement to The Intercept, adding, "The U.S. Marshals Service takes any allegation of misconduct by our personnel or task force partners seriously, and we are currently gathering information regarding the incident." The Department of Justice Civil Rights Division, United States Attorney Office, and the FBI have opened an investigation, and if the investigation reveals prosecutable violations of any federal criminal status, the department will take appropriate action. Lawrence Blackmon, the attorney for Harris and her son, said he believed that a warrant existed, but that officers acted improperly by not producing it at the time of the arrest. Blackmon and National Civil Rights Attorney Ben Crom are representing the Harrises. The issue here is not the validity of the warrant. It's the way the warrant was carried out, Blackmon told The Intercept. Mainstream national media have so far demonstrated little interest in the case, potentially because of the severity of the allegations and charges against the boys. The Canton shootings in August, for which both boys have been charged, along with a 17-year-old who is the brother of one of the boys and another 24-year-old man, resulted in the death of two people, including a 6-year-old boy, and injured another man. The boys are presumed innocent until proven guilty, but law enforcement agencies and media, including local outlets that covered the arrest, aren't framing them as such. Despite the fact that the boys are minors, numerous local outlets printed stories with their full names, and some included their mugshots. WLBT reported the boys' names are suspects in the August shooting prior to their arrest. The treatment fits into a dangerous pattern in which the media portrays young black boys as menacing adults, an approach that has shaped the coverage of arrests and high-profile police killings of black men for decades. The footage goes on to show the officers take Harris' godsister to the ground and handcuff her while she's lying on her stomach. Officers ask her to identify one of the boys, who is handcuffed nearby, while she tries to explain that she is house-sitting. One officer slaps her on the back of her shoulder while she is face down on the ground. Another officer tells her that they are both going to jail. A third officer repeatedly tells her to shut up. "I think you are making me dumber," he says. "Shut up, goddamn." Later in a video, an officer leads a second shirtless boy out of the house. In the background, one officer slams the first boy to the ground. As the officer walks with the second boy, another officer strikes him across the face, making a loud noise and drawing blood as the boy cries out. Both Harris' godsister and the boy who was struck said the officer was holding a black object in his hand. It's unclear from the video footage.